Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of Criminal Discourse Podcast. I'm Trish.
And I'm Maddie.
So in our last episode, Maddie, I gave some clues to what this week's episode would be about. And we did have two correct guesses. So
woohoo,
we get two special shout outs to B.L. Hemingway and Molly H. Molly even offered to guest host if we can figure out how to make that work. She lives in the Southeast United States.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. I'd love that. So we'll definitely keep that in mind, Molly. So thank you, B.L. Hemingway and Molly, for your guesses. And just another shout out to Bethany R. She reached out to us through, I believe, Instagram Messenger. If I figured that out, you know I'm not tech savvy. So they come up and I'm just so happy we get contact. But she just finished Crime Junkies and found us. And she was so glad we did. She said we make her workday more enjoyable. So thank you, Bethany R.
At least we make somebody's day more enjoyable.
That can't always be said. That is correct. So I also want to take a moment to thank two listeners that reached out to us that had personal connections to cases we covered. And these two cases were the Ashley Harris case and the Aaron H. Thomas case. He was the East Coast rapist. And I just want to let them both know that their messages really were touching and to thank them for taking the time to reach out and share their connection with us. I thought that's, you know, we do these cases because they're intriguing and they're fascinating, but sometimes we don't think, you know, the people listening have connections to these cases.
Yeah.
If you would like to reach out to us like Molly or B.L. Hemingway, you can do so through our contact page on our website at criminaldiscoursepodcast.com. On our website, you will find all of our show notes and resources that we use to bring you our episodes. We also have a Facebook page by the same name and an Instagram page under Criminal Dis Pod that you can subscribe to, and a YouTube channel along with the 33 other subscribers we currently have.
Ooh, getting them YouTube subscribers.
All 33 of them. So I thank all 33 of them, actually. Okay, are you ready for this week's episode?
I don't know, Trish.
It's a little bit of a rough one. This came from a listener, Kendra, and I've mentioned her before. She gave us the suggestion for the Girl Scout murders. So we're going to go to Locust Grove, Oklahoma, which is located in Mays County, slightly northeast of Tulsa. Now, this is named after a grove of locust trees where the Battle of Locust Grove took place that occurred on July 3rd, 1862, when 250 Union Army soldiers skirmished with a similar size of Confederate troops, killing about 100 Confederate troops, capturing the other 100, with the remaining 50 being deserters. So, the Battle of Locust Grove. This small town has known its share of tragedy, from the Civil War battle to the assassination of the county attorney in June of 1952 to an E. coli outbreak in August of 2008. And unfortunately, our story just kind of adds to that tragedy. So on June 12, 1977, approximately 130 young Girl Scouts from all over the Tulsa area gathered at the Magic Empire Girl Scout headquarters. That was the name of the... At first, I wasn't sure what Magic Empire...
Magic Empire?
Magic Empire, yes. And it was located in Tulsa, and they were preparing to board a caravan of buses for their annual week-long camping excursion to Camp Scott. Now, Camp Scott was located 2 miles from the town of Locust Grove and about 50 miles from Tulsa. And this Girl Scouts had been... Well, I think it was the Girl Scouts... and Boy Scouts had been operating Camp Scott since 1928. So Camp Scott sat on about 410 acres of densely wooded terrain. So I'm going to describe the camp setup to you a little bit because that's kind of important. They had different campsites split up around this acreage based upon the age of the campers. So one of the camps, the one we're going to be talking about, was the Kiowa Camp. And that was the camp for the younger girls. So this camp, the tents were set up in a horseshoe pattern. And the tents were 12 by 14 canvas tents set up on wooden platforms that held about 3 or 4 cots inside of them. And so again, in that horseshoe pattern. And each of these camping areas that they had over the whole camp was named after different Native American tribes. So you had Cherokee, I believe, was one, the Kiowa, I think there might have been Sioux, but there were various camps, again, based on the ages.
And the younger group, so the Kiowa, like what age range is that?
I think it was like from the youngest campers that could go, 8 or 9, maybe up to 12, 13.
Okay.
It sounded like that was the age range. They didn't give, I couldn't find a specific age range. So one tent in particular, number 7 in the Kiowa camp, was located at the end of the horseshoe configuration. And this was the farthest one. So it was kind of directly across from the counselor's tent on the other side.
Mm.
So they weren't closely together per se. And there were trees in between. So it's not like you could easily see, you know, like the tent next to you or tents, 2 tents down. So again, kind of keep in mind a densely wooded area. So one of the campers who would be staying in tent 7 was 10-year-old Doris Denise Milner. Now, Denise was from Tulsa. Her father was a Tulsa police officer. And this would be Denise's first time at Camp Scott. And she was really excited about the prospect of going to Camp Scott initially because she had worked her butt off selling Girl Scout cookies. Side note, I love my Thin Mints and Samoas. So she really worked hard to sell the cookies to be able to go to camp. And she thought she was going with other girls in her troop. But unfortunately, she ended up being the only one. So she was really kind of reluctant to go. Like, she was already getting homesickness before even getting on the bus.
Well, and if she didn't know any of the other girls, right. And it's, yeah.
And the other thing about Denise was she was the only African-American girl in the group. And so I think she was kind of a little hesitant with that, not knowing anyone. When they got to the headquarters, she didn't really want to go. She wanted to stay with her mom and her younger sister. But her mom, like any mom's, like, oh my gosh, you work so hard for this. Come on, you can do this. Just go. But if you don't like it, I'll come and get you. You know, kind of thing. But I want you to at least try.
Mm-hmm.
So when they were in the holding place, this was when 15-year-old Michelle Hoffman, she was a first-time camp counselor that year. She had gone to Camp Scott previously as a Girl Scout, but this was the first time she was going to be a counselor. And she noticed Denise, and she took it upon herself to introduce herself to her and her mom, and she took her under her wing, and she actually rode on the bus with her, and she just kind of really talked to her about the great things they were going to do all week at camp. And Michelle had promised Denise's mother that Denise would be able to use a phone and call home the next day if she wanted to go home. So that was the agreement. So all the campers arrived at Camp Scott between 3:30 and 4 p.m. on the 12th. And Denise soon met her two bunkmates, Lori Farmer, age 8. She was actually one of the youngest campers there. And Michelle Gousset, age 9. So Denise was 10, so she definitely was older than the other two. And the trio seemed to hit it off. So in all, there were 27 campers assigned to the Kiowa camp. Now, a thunderstorm had rolled through camp in the early evening hours, but soon the camp was enjoying a late Sunday evening sing-alongs in the dining hall, and they were getting like the camp rules and the expectations, and I think certain campers were assigned certain chores each day, and they talked about what the next day would bring. So after all that, the campers and the counselors headed to their tents, really kind of exhausted of that first day. So Michelle even checked in with Denise before she settled in and saw that Denise and her tent mates were getting along nicely. And she told them good night and I'll see you in the morning. Okay, so there was a final check on all the girls in Camp Kiowa around 10:30 by another camp counselor. And it was around 11:30 p.m. One of the counselors assigned to Camp Kiowa went to quiet a couple of the tents down. You know, some of the girls, you know, they weren't going to settle down. They were too excited. But this did not include Tent 7 or Tent 6. Now, I will say this as a precursor. There are some articles out there that mention Tent 8 as the tent that Denise and Lori and Michelle were in. But I had read the pretrial hearing transcripts, and they all mention Tent 7. So that's the one I'm going with. So if you read any news articles, you may say, oh, it's Tent 8. But in the pretrial, they were all in Tent 7. So that same counselor got up again shortly after midnight when the girls from Tent 1 had all gone to the bathroom together, and they were making a lot of noise. So she, you know, went...
The normal camp counselor stuff. Yes. Yeah.
Like, yep. Okay, ladies, let's get back to our tents. Let's settle down. She escorted them back. And she observed no other noises or anything from any other tents at that time. Now, around 1:30 a.m., the girls from Tent 4 were talking and not really settling down. They were going strong. And again, the same counselor got up and made her way there and was like, okay, guys, you need to settle down. You're going to have a big day tomorrow. Let's tune in. And again, she observed nothing unusual outside of the girls in Tent 4 talking. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about the campers in Tent 7. So where Denise was the only African-American camper, Lori Farmer, like I said, was one of the youngest. But despite her age, she was really kind of advanced for her years. At 8 years old, she was the oldest of the 5 Farmer children. She was a bright, young, mature girl who excelled in school, and she even skipped second grade and just finished her 4th grade year at Jinx Elementary School. Now, her parents are Dr. Charles Farmer and Sherry Farmer, and they were really excited for Lori to attend her first Girl Scout camp. And they made plans, though, to surprise Lori for her 9th birthday, which was on the following Saturday, June 18th. So Michelle Gousset was excited to return to Camp Scott for her second year. So unlike Denise and Lori, who were both from Tulsa, Michelle was from Broken Arrow, and she had gone to Camp Scott before. So she was like, oh yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm so excited. But before she left home, she made her family promise to take care of her plants. She was a bit of a horticulturalist, and she loved her African violets. So she made sure her family knew how to properly take care of her plants while she was away for the week. So prior to leaving for camp, Michelle regaled her family with all the things she was excited to do for camp. You know, so she was really looking forward to it. So again, Michelle, Lori, and Denise did not know each other prior to the first day of camp. There was actually another little girl who was supposed to be in their tent, but due to the storm that had moved in suddenly, she had ended up staying at another campsite. And I think somehow she got assigned to mistakenly, but she was going to, I think, move back to Camp Kiowa the next day or so and join the other girls. So by 8 a.m. on Monday, June 13th, news would be breaking all over the Tulsa area of the murders of three Girl Scouts at Camp Scott. The news would continue to break throughout the morning, with details emerging that three young campers had been bludgeoned to death and sexually assaulted. Parents began racing to the Girl Scout headquarters, wanting to know what was going on, when they could be reunited with their daughters. You got to remember, this was 1977. There were no 24-hour newscasts. Mm-mm. There wasn't, you know, Fox, MSNBC, CNN, all of those people covering the news 24/7. There was no Twitter. There was no cell phone. So you were just getting the news when it came over the radio or the TV. And so parents were rushing to the headquarters. And by 2:15 that afternoon, Greyhound buses would be entering the lot, unloading the girls that had just left from the day before. Now, what the girls didn't know, what had been discovered at 6 a.m. by a camp counselor on her way to the bathhouse. So as this counselor had walked along the trail to the bathhouse, she discovered a little girl lying on top of her sleeping bag near the base of the tree. So at first the counselor thought, what's going on here? You know, has this been an accident? What's going on? And she immediately ran back to the other counselor tent, yelling him to get up and do a head count. She was unsure what was going on. So one of the counselors started the head count. The other counselor got to her car and jumped in it to go get the camp director and the camp nurse to bring them back. So when they were doing the head count, when they got to tent 7 and looked inside, they didn't see any of the girls or their sleeping bags or mattress coverings, but they did see a lot of blood. So as they're coming back with the camp director and the camp nurse, they walk the same trail that the counselor had walked to the bathhouse. And that's when not only do they discover the one girl who's lying under the tree on top of her sleeping bag, they discover the two other girls still in their sleeping bag. And all of them were unfortunately dead. The three girls were all from Tent 7, which was about 150 feet from where they would ultimately be found. Lori and Michelle were the ones found lying side by side in their sleeping bags, while Denise was found lying on top of hers. So when the counselor initially walked the trail and came upon Denise's body, she had found that she was lying on the ground on her back. Her eyes were open. She was naked from the waist down with her legs spread wide and her hands were bound behind her back. She looked to have been hit on the head as she had dried blood on her forehead. Now, the other two bodies were found in their sleeping bag a short distance away. So initially, when that counselor came across Denise's body, she only thought there was one of them. She never saw the other two that were a short distance away. And I think when they questioned her, she said she may have seen their sleeping bags and thought maybe it was just luggage being dropped off, like it hadn't been delivered to the campsites yet.
Yeah.
So there was a lot, I can imagine, just a lot of shock and confusion. What's going on here? So by 7:30 a.m., law enforcement would be on the scene. All three girls would be removed to the county coroner's office for autopsies. Now, again, I got to be honest, I could not find a lot of information on their autopsies. And I read various articles that said all three had been sexually assaulted. That was the news breaking all over Tulsa. I read articles that only two of them were assaulted, and they didn't really even name the two that were assaulted. So the majority of information I tried to get from their pretrial transcripts. So Lori and Michelle's autopsies would show they had been beaten to death, while Denise had also been beaten, but her ultimate cause of death was due to strangulation. Time of death was between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m. So only two of the girls, Denise and Michelle, had cords tied around their bodies in what looked like a double half-hitch knot. The cords were wrapped around their bodies and then tied to their wrists that were behind their backs. So what investigators determined at the time was the attack seemed to have started in the girls' tent. That's where the majority of the blood was found, where one or more assailants entered through the back of the tent, striking Lori and Michelle on their head. And again, blood was everywhere. There was blood on the pillows, cots, floor. And on June 14th, the wooden floor itself of tent number 7 would be airlifted to the crime lab. Evidence showed that the blood on the floor looked to have been wiped up using either a towel or the mattress covers. Now, prints would also be found in the blood, indicating a tennis shoe, with another different print found outside the tent. So again, investigators were thinking, okay, we possibly have more than one assailant here. Now, other evidence found at the scene were fingerprints found on the bodies. At least that was what was initially reported. Also a flashlight, duct tape, and pieces of cord. Now, later the coroner would come out and say what they thought were fingerprints on the bodies were not. So they didn't have any fingerprints. And investigators questioned all three counselors assigned to Camp Kiowa. Again, kind of getting their timeline of what happened that night and what they saw. So one of the largest manhunts in Oklahoma history at this time would begin, looking for the killer or killers of these three young victims. Now, not only law enforcement officials were involved, but volunteers, tracking dogs, aircraft were used to scour the thickly brushed area. Tracking dogs from Pennsylvania were even brought in. They called them the Wonder Dogs. Now, these dogs started searching on June 16th and were able to find, through their search, some other evidence. One was eyeglasses and a case belonging to one of the counselors. And this was outside of her tent out in the woods. So for 9 days, the search continued, turning really up next to nothing after that. But on day 10, that all changed when Mays County's District Attorney Sid Weiss held a press conference where he named a suspect in the triple homicide of Denise, Lori, and Michelle. The suspect, Gene Leroy Hart, a 33-year-old Locust Grove native who was currently on the run for the past 4 years after escaping from the Mays County Jail. He was serving over a 300-year sentence, I believe it was 309 years, after being convicted of 4 counts of burglary. And he was still on the run. So at the time of the murders, he's still on the run after he escaped jail. But some evidence from the search led to a small cave near Camp Scott. It was about 3 miles away from Camp Scott that seemed to tie Hart to not only staying in the cave, but to Camp Scott. Things stolen from Camp Scott.
Oh, they found, okay. In the cave, they found stuff that was stolen from the camp?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Gene Leroy Hart is described as being 5'10". He is a Cherokee Native American weighing approximately 200 pounds with black hair and brown eyes. Now, Hart had been a star football player for the Locust Grove High School, and many who knew him could not comprehend that this quiet, well-liked boy could have done something like this. This just didn't fit their image of him or how they knew him.
So did you say 300 years for burglary?
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that. Hold on, thought.
I'm just okay. Oh, no. Sorry. Wait. Circling back. I'm like, oh, what? Huh?
No, wait. Wait, you're gonna, yeah, just wait. We're coming back to that. So now high school is high school, and after high school is something else. Because when Hart was 22 years old, he abducted 2 women from a Tulsa area nightclub. He took them to a remote wooded area where he proceeded to rape them both. He then covered their mouths with duct tape and covered them up with leaves and debris, planning to leave the pair out there to die. But the pair were able to escape, and they identified Hart as their attacker. And Hart pleaded guilty. He admitted that he had done that. He was sentenced to 3 10-year concurrent sentences. I believe 2 counts of rape and then the kidnapping.
10 years?
Yes. 10 years to run concurrently.
Right.
So not like 10, 10, 10, no, 30 like years.
10.
Oh, but wait. He would be granted parole after serving only 28 months. 2 years, 4 months.
For abduction and rape.
Mm-hmm. Got out in 2 years, 4 months. So in 1969, he's on parole and he was once again arrested, this time for burglary, and charged with 4 counts of first-degree burglary. He had burglarized 3 homes in the Tulsa area while the occupants were asleep inside. So the last home he burglarized was actually an apartment of a female Tulsa police officer. So that didn't work out well for him. And he was caught. I think she had just gone to bed and she heard somebody coming through her door. And of course, she's an officer. She has a gun. She identifies herself. They take off. She calls the police. So they come. And while they're talking to her, they hear someone trying to get into the apartment above her. Well, that was him. I know.
Okay.
The listeners can't see your face of dumbfoundedness, but yes. So he's arrested.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to go through the thought process of you break in, police officer identifies herself. I believe, you run upstairs to the next apartment.
I guess that one's not going to work. I'm going to go out to the next one. So he ends up pleading not guilty this time around. But because he was on parole and because he committed these felony burglaries, he was sentenced to over 300 years. Didn't get 300 years for the abduction rapes. No, no. Now, he never assaulted anyone in these apartments. He never threatened anyone with a weapon. 3 of them didn't even know their house was broken into. Right. So he gets 300 years for these, though. But Hart really didn't want to stay in jail because he escaped jail in 1973 and was still on the lam at the time of the murders. So by the time Hart was named as a suspect, he definitely still had his supporters in the area. And these included former teachers and peers, and they felt he was being used as a scapegoat by the area sheriff. His supporters felt that he was being targeted since he was a Native American, and he had embarrassed the sheriff by escaping his jail, not once apparently, but twice. So they thought this was maybe payback.
Man, it must have been easy to break out of jail in the 70s.
Well, it was a county jail, too. It wasn't a prison.
Okay.
So keep that in mind. So Hart's luck ran out, and on April 6, 1978, 10 months after the murders, Hart was captured hiding out in a small shack in Cookston Hills in Cherokee County. Police had acted on a tip that Hart was holding up in the shack owned by Sam Pigeon, a Native American medicine man. Sam would be later arrested along with another medicine man for aiding and abetting. So Hart this time was transported to Oklahoma State Penitentiary. He wasn't going back to the county jail because he already escaped from it twice. So in March 1979, the capital murder trial of Gene Leroy Hart was finally underway. Now, Hart pleaded not guilty in the first-degree murders of Denise Milner, Lori Farmer, and Michelle Gousset.
And just so I know, which I'm sure we're going to get to this, but at this point, the only evidence we know of tying him to these murders was the cave?
Yeah. Some stuff will come out. Yeah, I'll get to that.
Okay.
But yes. So Hart's trial would take place in Mays County Courthouse in Pryor with the Honorable Judge William Whistler presiding. S.M. Buddy Fallis would represent the state. He was a district attorney from Tulsa County. Now, Sid Wise had withdrawn from the case because remember, he was the one that broke the news that it was Hart who was the suspect in these murders initially. Mm-hmm. But he had to withdraw from the case after receiving some heat and backlash for shopping a book around about the murders. You know, before the trial took place. So Garvin Isaacs would be the attorney for the defense. So on March 5th, 1979, after a long, drawn-out preliminary hearing process, the trial was finally underway. Jury selection took up to 10 days with 110 prospective jurors' questions, 6 men and 6 women with occupations ranging from school teacher, plant manager, a gas firm foreman, and a housewife would be seated. Now, none of the jurors were from Locust Grove, and the jurors were all sequestered for the entirety of the trial. Now, the state case really seemed to rely on 2 key pieces of evidence. Now, one, there were hair and semen samples found on the girls and items that could place Hart near the crime scene. We talked about the eyeglasses and its case that was stolen from Camp Scott the night of the murders, and they would be found near the bodies. I'm not sure how they traced them to Hart because I don't think they were necessarily found in the cave, or at least I couldn't tell if they were found in the cave, but duct tape that matched tape found at the scene, I believe, was in the cave, and a photo in the cave was linked to Hart's time in the prison photo lab. When he had been in Mays County Prison, he worked in the photo lab, and this photo matched photos, I guess, that were developed there. That's the best way I could describe it. So yes, the evidence was very flimsy. So the state's theory was that Hart entered the back of tent 7, striking both Lori and Michelle in their head. He then bound and gagged Denise, taking her from the tent where he proceeded to rape and strangle her, and then proceeded to remove the other 2 victims from the tent to where they were ultimately found. So the prosecutor had to admit that there was no definitive evidence linking Hart to the scene, but the DNA that was recovered, according to expert testimony at trial, could be linked to Hart. Keep in mind, DNA testing wouldn't really come in to the late 1980s. So this was, I think, through maybe the blood?
Yeah, the typing.
Yes. So the defense strategy was to put the investigation on trial to show that they were scapegoating an innocent man, going so far to insinuate that the evidence found in the cave had been planted. They even gave an alternative suspect, Bill Stevens, a convicted rapist who at the time of Hart's trial was serving time in a Kansas prison for rape. So William A. Stevens' name was brought up and would play a key figure in Hart's trial. 2 witnesses would testify at Hart's trial that Stevens had showed up at their door the day after the murders with scratches all over his arms and what looked like blood on his shoes. They also said that the red flashlight found at the scene was Stevens. So the Girl Scout murders, one thing I want to point out, and you can find this in our show notes under girlscoutmurders.com/criminal profile. This is a website where you can find pictures relating to this case. It's a fascinating website. So they have pictures of this case along with news accounts and the trial transcript. That's where I found the trial transcripts. And they show pictures of the crime scene. So, I mean, not in graphic detail, but you can tell enough.
Right.
And they do show this flashlight. It's a red box-like flashlight, so not a cylinder one.
Okay.
And it had been found near the bodies. Now, Stevens, however, denied their story, claiming he was at work in Seminole at the time of the murders, and he had been backed up by his employer's paycheck and time card at the time. So what later came out, I believe, is that these 2 witnesses that testified had something against Stevens or were trying to set Stevens up. So that didn't really go anywhere. But at the time of the trial, Here, these two witnesses are testifying to an alternative
suspect.
Correct. Yeah. So Hart's trial lasted 10 days with Hart not taking the stand in his own defense. Observers, including the victim's family, would say Hart's trial had more of a performance atmosphere, with the battling attorneys being called to the bench several times for their theatric. Now, the victim's families also reported that even though there was not an openly hostile environment at the trial, it was not far from it, as Hart supporters clearly were in evidence, being outside the courtroom, inside the courtroom. One article I read described how the victims' families would go to a local restaurants for lunch, only to walk in and see big fundraising jars on the counter for Hart's defense.
Oh my God, yeah.
So 6.5 hours after the case was put into the jury's hands, they had a verdict. The court clerk read the verdict. Not guilty. One of the jurors would later state that within 5 minutes of entering the deliberation room, all 12 had voted not guilty. The jury felt that there were too many loose ends and that they were shocked that the prosecution didn't have more evidence. Now, there is a documentary on that website I mentioned earlier, and you can watch it. You click on it, and it brings up Stateline, which reminded me of Dateline, but Stateline, and it's on the Girl Scout murders, where they interview one of the jury members who says she felt that at least one police officer was lying to the jury. This officer, when asked if there were any photos of the police taking Hart into custody, he said no, but then the defense got up and showed that there were multiple photos of Hart being led away by the police in handcuffs. So to the defense, this was like, why would you lie?
Yeah.
And if you're lying about this,
what else could you be lying about? Especially when they're saying that they may have planted evidence and there's,
Correct. It kind of falls into that defensive theory.
I'm not surprised by that verdict. Like, there was nothing. I mean, granted, it's the 70s, so it's not like you're going to have DNA, which is what we all want now. But there doesn't seem to be a whole lot.
Right. There's no witnesses. There's no DNA. So Denise, Michelle, and Lori's families, of course, were devastated by the verdict. Hart, however, would not be a free man. He still had to serve.
Yeah, he still had 300 years to serve anyway.
Correct. So he still had those 300 years to serve for first degree burglary. 2 years after Hart's acquittal, news came that Hart had actually died from a heart attack after collapsing in the prison exercise yard where he'd been lifting weights. So he didn't have to serve his 300 years. His funeral would be held in Locust Grove with over 1,000 mourners.
He had to be really young. He was 22 in what, 69? So he had to be like early 30s?
Yeah, he wasn't that old. Now, again, all these mourners show up at his funeral. What struck me about that is, okay, he had all these supporters, but you have to remember, he pleaded guilty to abduction rape. Yeah. He wasn't a good guy. And yet, I don't know, that baffled me when I read that. I'm like, y'all know he admitted to raping those two girls, to abducting them and raping them. One article I read, I think one of the girls was pregnant. So, I mean, it's just, he wasn't a good guy. Now, each of the victim's family members struggled, of course, in the aftermath of Hart's acquittal and ultimately his death. It brought very little comfort to them. So in 1984, the Milner and Farmer families filed a civil suit against the Magic Council Girl Scout organization, citing negligence in their daughter's murders, and that they were partly responsible because of that negligence and not providing adequate security. So now, it was only Milner and Farmer. Gousset didn't join the lawsuit, but they were in agreement that they felt, yes, that their daughters were not adequately protected. So they didn't feel that the council did an adequate job of lighting, security guards, the distance between the counselor tents and the campers in an overgrowth area and the sleeping areas was not secure. Now, at Camp Stevens, there was a ranger hired to keep the camp in order and run off any trespassers, and he was present the night of the murder. But I don't think, again, I didn't read anything that he nightly patrolled. Hmm. I think he was on site.
Well, that doesn't really do you much good, does it?
Right. So they were seeking a combined judgment of $3 million. Now, at trial, there was testimony from former campers and counselors as to some strange occurrences that had happened prior to June 12, 1970. Now, prior to the murders, when the counselors were at Camp Scott for training, one of the counselors reported that her belongings had been gone through and that donuts she had bought that were in a box had been stolen out of her tent. Now, in the donut box was a note that said, quote, "We plan on killing three little girls," unquote. So this counselor immediately took the note to the camp director, who thought it was a prank, and it didn't go any farther than that.
Mm. And this was how many weeks before?
This was about 2 months. So maybe 6 to 8 weeks before the girls showed up. I mean, when I was researching this and I read that, like, pranks happen at camp. Have you ever gone to camp, summer camp?
Not like that. I've gone to like camp, but you're in a hotel.
Okay, that's not camp.
No. Okay. So no, I said, no, not really. Okay. No, I was not a Girl Scout. I went like once and I was like, this is a little touchy feely for me.
Okay.
And then I tried to be a Boy Scout, but they wouldn't let me.
I was not a Girl Scout either, but I did go to camp when I was late elementary, early middle school. It was a Christian church camp and it was called Camp Penn. So when I'm researching this story, so many things come up. And the pranking part really got to me. My second year at Camp Penn, I was in a camp in the lodge where It was directly across from the main lodge, but it was up butted against the woods. So it was a really big, long cabin where you walked in one end and it had like the counselor's room, private room, and then just a big, long area where with, like, all the beds. They weren't bunk beds. Everybody had their individual cots. And then at the end was like a little bathroom area that led to another long cabin and then a door out the other end. So it was probably about our second or third night there that things started to go missing or being moved. So they had to talk to us about respecting other people's stuff. And we're all like, yeah, we're not touching other people's stuff. But then stranger things started happening. Like, you'd come back and beds would be roughed up and things dumped out on beds. Like, okay, who's doing this? That's the prankster part. Like, so it was probably about the fifth night there. Me and a couple girls were like, can we go back to the cabin to get our sweatshirts? Because we were going to do a campfire and it was getting a little cold. I remember we went back and we immediately knew something wasn't right. And I was leaning down to get my sweatshirt and the girl behind me, I remember go, and I remember turning to my left and the windows in the cabin were near the ceiling, those long windows.
Yeah, like up top.
Up top. And I remember when I turned, seeing someone in the window, but they were wearing a devil's mask. I remember it being red. And let me tell you, Usain Bolt had nothing on us girls because we ripped out of that cabin and ran back to the main dining hall to tell them what happened, what we saw. So immediately, you know, all the guys in the camp and the adults are going back to the cabin. And they did find something on the We found out later on the outside, the one that butted up against the woods, someone clearly had something up against the cabin looking in the window. They had to stand on something to be able to look in the window. So that night, there were a lot of roving patrols. And again, we were only there another day or so. And some girls left, though. Some were like, we're out, call our parents.
Yeah.
And they left. So when you talk about pranksting, and again, it was, you know, things were stolen, things were moved. I know a couple girls, I think, had underwear stolen. Yeah. And bathing suits and things. So it could have gotten really... you know?
Yeah, I feel like there should have been some action taken.
I'm sure that we weren't privy to all that. We were young. I think they were trying to protect us to like, okay, it's okay. And they did do patrols and there were people up all night.
And wouldn't this have been like around the same time frame?
A little later. I went to Camp Penn. Yeah, I would say 78, 79. Okay, well, maybe a year or two later.
And this was after the Girl Scout murders?
Yes, it
was. Guys, come on. Come on, Camp Penn.
Okay, I didn't know about the Girl Scout murders back then. But when, you know, the camp director was thinking it was just a prank. Because pranks happen at camp, so she didn't think anything of it. Now, in another incident, a counselor in a training reported hearing noises behind the staff housing unit. She felt that the sounds were made by a human. And when she called out, again, you're in a camp in the woods. Don't call out. Like, she calls out to this person, but she can hear footsteps, but no one answered. But the camp dog, whose name's Sally, started barking and growling. And Sally didn't really do that. So she knew someone was outside the staffing unit. So the jury, in a 9-3 vote, though, voted in favor of the defendants, which was the Magic Council. And the judgment was upheld 2 years later from the state appeals court. So in 1989, DNA tested was conducted on some of the evidence that showed five tracers or aspects, they call them, were tested. And three of them matched body fluids taken from Jean Leroy Hart, meaning only one in 7,700 Native Americans would match. But because there were only three of the five aspects, they deemed them inconclusive. So in 2017, fundraising efforts were underway for a more conducive DNA testing. And at the time, the last thing I read, they've raised over $30,000, but I couldn't read anymore if it's ever gone to testing. So I don't know where they're at in that.
Which I don't understand how that's even possible, because even if since there was an acquittal, wouldn't that still be an open case?
Yes, it is still an open case.
So then why isn't Oklahoma doing this testing?
Well, I think they are. They're just raising money for more conducive testing.
Come on, Oklahoma taxpayers. Isn't that part of, am I wrong?
No, I just think they probably have a lot. DNA testing is not cheap, and I'm going to say, but yeah. All right, Maddie's all fired up
on
Oklahoma.
I'm sorry, but it's three little girls and they don't even know if they had the right guy.
Correct.
Especially when you see it was flimsy evidence. He was acquitted. It's an open case.
Yes. I will say, at the time, after his acquittal, they did ask the current sheriff and the prosecutor, would they retry? I mean, they couldn't retry him. Double jeopardy's attached. But would they continue to investigate the murders? And they basically said, we found the guy who did it. The jury got it wrong. Now, an incoming sheriff, or there was an election where a new sheriff running ran on the platform that he would reinvestigate the murders if elected. And he was elected. And I think he initially started to, but it didn't really go anywhere. So it is still an open case. They did have another suspect, Carl Myers. He was a convicted murderer who apparently had confessed to one of his former cellmates, but he died in 2013 of natural causes. So I'm not sure why. I just saw that his name was brought up as a possible suspect too. So the families that are left behind after these tragedies, of course, they don't really have justice. I think they felt, though, that Jean Hart was the one that did this to their daughters for the most part. But again, they didn't get justice. He got acquitted. So the farmers channeled their grief. They organized the Oklahoma chapter of Parents of Murdered Children. And Richard Gousset threw himself into victims' right advocacy. And in the 1980s, he helped push the passing of the Crime Victims Witness Bill of Rights. And he was later appointed to the Crime Victims Compensation Board by the Oklahoma's then governor. So that is the Girl Scout murders. Frustrating.
Yeah, I'm not satisfied.
I'm sorry. I do like when we do cases when there's a conclusion, but this is really...
I just think this is ridiculous. Test the DNA, guys.
Well, and the problem is, can they? I've read some things that the DNA might have not been secured correctly, and it depends on how big of a sample's left, and if they, you know, secured and stored all of the evidence, the girl's clothing, the girl's sleeping bag, was that stored properly that they can go back and get DNA from? I don't know. So there's a lot of factors.
I'm very upset about this.
I'm sorry I ruined your day. I don't know what more to say about that. Okay.
I'm going to do some investigating at why there's, I don't understand why there's a fundraiser. Why there has to be, I guess.
Well, but you know, we've heard those cases and we've covered cases where cold case grants are given, like states are given grants to reopen investigations, or cold case units are giving grants to reopen investigations.
Yeah, what's that show? Let's send that lady.
Cece Moore?
Yeah, let's send her.
Well, I think they need DNA first. I don't know how much DNA is left.
Okay, so then why are they having a fundraiser if they don't know if there's enough DNA? Like, I feel like that question should be answered.
That I don't know. You'd have to ask Oklahoma.
All right, well, I'm calling Oklahoma.
Okay.
I'm calling the sheriff.
I don't know if he'll talk to you, but okay.
Rigged sheriff elections.
It's not a rigged sheriff election. And this guy, the guy you're going to call, had nothing to do with murders. All right. So I'll let Maddie go on her advocacy route there. But in other news, we do have other crime update news.
I didn't do my news update noise. Do, 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 do.
And in other crime news, if you follow the Sheila Keen Warren case, this is the killer clown case out of Florida. Sheila Keen Warren has been in jail awaiting trial for the last 3 years for the murders of Marlene Ahearns. And this murder occurred in May of 1990. So I think she was originally supposed to go to trial like last year, but then the pandemic hit. So she's been in jail this whole time. So her defense attorneys are asking for her to be released on bail until her trial, which is to begin in April of this year.
I doubt it. If it's supposed to be in April.
And whether, yeah.
You've already been in there 3 years, girlfriend.
We'll see. So thank you all for taking the time to listen. We hope you found this case as intriguing and, in Maddie's case, frustrating as we have. Maddie and I would ask that if you like what we've been doing here at Criminal Discourse, that you leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to us on. And if you leave us a 5-star, we would appreciate it even more. And as always, if you see something, say something. You might have that missing piece of the puzzle it takes to solve a crime. Maybe if you're the camp director
and
you got it.
Yeah, if you're a camp counselor, do some patrols with a taser.
Well, actually, I will say this about now when you go to camps, there's much tighter security, and it is because of this case. It really is. Now, Camp Scott was done. Like, when those girls left camp that day, when they were bussed back to the headquarters the next day, Camp Scott never reopened. So you can see pictures of it. It's in a deteriorating state, but you can see pictures of the old platform, of the swimming pool, of the dining hall. I think some people bought in. It's now hunting grounds, used for like private hunting grounds. But they did open, I think it was a couple years later, another camp, not in the same area, for Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. But everything's different now. And it's different because of this case. So as always, we want you to be safe. We're slowly inching our way towards vaccines. So hopefully by summer, if not fall, we can get back to some sense of normalcy. But we want you to be safe. Continue to wear your mask. Continue to wash your hands. Continue to social distance. And of course, in these crazy times, we definitely need to be more kind to one another. So until next time, guys.
Bye.